Good afternoon. Welcome to the panel on RNZ National. Wallace Chapman with you this afternoon. A couple of your favourite songs that I haven't heard of, actually, or not so familiar with. Try Mark Kozlik's. Mark Kozlik sings Christmas carols. It's a nonchalant take on carols that's actually bearable. Have you heard of Mark Kozlik, Sam?
No, I haven't actually.
No, there's one. Christmas songs. John Lennon's Happy Christmas, War is Over is the best Christmas song I've ever heard. Most others you hear, rubbish, says Carl. 2101 is the number to text here on the panel. With me this afternoon, Ruth Money, victims advocate, Sam Johnson, a social entrepreneur. This first, Air New Zealand has today axed hundreds more cabin crew jobs. 400 cabin crew jobs that had been under review are set to go. The company has dissolved 4,000 jobs since the start of COVID-19 out of about 12,500. This against a backdrop of gloom for air travel internationally. The International Air Transport Association warns of devastation for airlines as the outlook worsens. They expect the full year of 2020 traffic to be down 66% compared to last year, a far more grim outlook than earlier in the year, with revenue calculated to be down 29%. With us is aviation commentator Peter Clark. Peter, welcome to the program. Are you there, Peter?
Yeah, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Yes, look, Peter, Wallace here from the panel. What do you take from these numbers? No other way to say it, quite eye-watering.
Yeah, I think we all knew this was coming, and it really shows the grim nature of this whole problem that we've now had, and we've seen the resurgence of this whole COVID situation in Europe, and we've now seen that the panacea that everyone was hoping for was with the vaccine, and now they're saying the early vaccines are going to have a limited effect. So it's an unfortunate situation. Air New Zealand has definitely tried their hardest to try and make this work, but as we've seen, they've traded off most of their large Boeing 777 aircraft. They're going to the desert, and they left with a basic crew, number of aircraft back in New Zealand.
Going to the desert, gosh. I mean, it is really quite obvious, isn't it? There is just not enough flying going on, as someone from the International Air Transport Association said.
Yeah, well, I think even IATA have really underestimated this. They were initially reporting that they wanted to get airlines back flying and getting borders open, and I think that countries have gone against IATA and have really said we are not going to be opening borders, and the whole industry is definitely going back further. So we are now reaching that realistic situation. Thank goodness we live in a country like New Zealand where our domestic travel is definitely back growing again, and it is developing strong. And New Zealand has definitely kept on their Boeing 787 fleets to be able to continue operations around this part of the world.
So just, IATA said the median airline internationally has just 8.5 months of cash remaining at current burn rates. So, expending a lot more cash than they are taking in. How do you read those figures? What do you see in a couple of years' time? Well, I was just talking off air. I can't really see anyone travelling, within the next 24 months?
Well, I can't see anything in the next 2 years at least. And airlines to recoup those losses are definitely going to be struggling into the future. We've seen a lot of the airlines now cutting back dramatically. We've seen a lot of airlines fail. We've seen airlines like British Airways and that getting rid of their larger fleets, Qantas, their larger fleets, Air New Zealand, their larger fleets, and that's where a lot of their revenue was from, long-haul big aircraft carrying freight and passengers. It's just a whole different world. No one would ever have believed this was going to happen, and we are trying to make it work. Air New Zealand hasn't drawn on the government money at this time, and they are really trying to make it work with the cash flows they have currently got.
So before we go to our panellists, is that a bit of an issue? Because we had a statement from Savage at Air 2, the union, saying, look, Air 2 has proposed using extended leave without pay options and extending existing reemployment clauses as possible solutions, but talks, haven't led to any agreement. Air New Zealand still has money there. Should they be laying off so many?
Well, what do you give them to do? I think we've got to be realistic now. The airline industry has gone back so far. The jobs are not there. The work is not there. Even the aircraft are not there anymore. You can only keep people out there for so long, and we know that the airline industry is taking the biggest hit in virtually of all of this, plus the tourism industry, which is associated with that. There is no answer, and I think Air New Zealand have done their best to try and keep things on a level playing field, but trying to just keep people hanging on without pay, these people have to start planning their future and new jobs and trying to make the best they can out of this terrible situation. I don't think anybody can give you an answer.
Ruth?
Yeah, I'd have to agree. And when I look at the domestic stuff, as much as it is increasing, I wonder for how long before Air New Zealand does need to put prices up to prop up supply and demand curves.
Well, I think if you're going to put prices up, you know, you then kill that domestic
That's
market.
Right.
It's a real balance to get Kiwis to fly to see their country, but you don't kill the golden egg.
Sam, what do you have a thought?
Yeah, I mean, I was expecting this and really been waiting for it. If anything, they probably should have done more right at the start. And I think what we're seeing is that they're having to look, fundamentally relook at how their costs are structured. And that's, the airlines are highly unionised. There's multiple collective agreements that run the different staff systems within the airlines. And I think what the only way I can see them surviving is by restructuring those and hiring back people as and when they need it in the future, so that we can keep flying, keep afford to fly, and actually stop the airline being nationalised and be able to keep it, keep our great airline. So it's a tough time.
What's wrong with nationalising the airline?
I'm a shareholder, so I don't want it nationalised, but I don't think we should be going there. I think the airline has to do, and it should do everything it can to stay as a private All company right. And continue.
All right, aviation commentator Peter Clark there. Thank you very much for your time there. 14 past four, the panel are in Z National. Crisis talks were understood to be held today to resolve the latest standoff engulfing the America's Cup. Cites the New Zealand Herald. Auckland Mayor Phil Goff requested an urgent meeting, we understand, with key stakeholders, including Nick Hill, Chief Executive of Auckland Tourism, and AT, that's the Events and Economic Development. Issues to be addressed include moving to scrap the Inner Harbour courses B and C, which apparently means that the city views will be lost and that spectators will be robbed of the best viewing experience. So what is happening in this key New Zealand event? With us is yachtswoman and sailing commentator Penny Whiting. Now, Penny was awarded an MBE for services to sailing and is with us now. Penny, welcome.
Well, thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Now, you've sailed some of these courses. How does it feel to you, Penny?
Well, I was out racing last night sailing around those two courses and through them, and they are lovely courses. Because I'm of the belief the best way to see any of this America's Cup is actually not going to be on a boat. It's going to be sitting on North Head on a cushion with lunch in your hand. And you can see the wind on the water. You can see the boat sailing. And you can even hear them easing the sails out. But anyway, at the moment, things are really up in the air with that possibility.
What a picture you paint, Penny. I can see myself on a cushion now, having a picnic hamper, having strawberries and some sparkling water. Now, for those who are not into sailing, explain the issue for us, because it seems to be quite a schmozzle.
Well, yes, I'm going to keep it as simple as I can.
Yeah, please.
The Prada Cup, it's called. They have a round robin series and a semi final series, and that's the early days. That's to find the challenger to go up against Emirates Team New Zealand, and they were never going to be on those two courses anyway, and then things have come up and said, well, we're not allowed to use them, you're not allowed to use them. But the Prada Cup finals, which used to be the Louis Vuitton Cup, were definitely going to be sailed in that vantage point right off North Head and Takapuna. And there's just a bit of argy-bargy going on, and people are flexing their muscles. But I'm of the belief that we're going to pull that off, so that incredible vantage point that I don't think anybody else has in the world is going to work out. You know, you can sit there and see the yachting below you, look at your iPhone and watch it on YouTube, because it's all free-to-air television and YouTube and stuff, and it is a great place to have view an event. But whether it really happens, I think it's still early days.
Yeah, so it's all about actually having the opportunity for people, everyday people, to watch this great event. And Sam Johnston, you thought the politics of Canterbury were a little bit complicated. Try yachting, right?
Well, that's right. I mean, I had the great privilege on the weekend to sail out with some friends on their little catamaran that they've rebuilt by hand out to Teretere Matangi, you know, the one that's in the Air New Zealand video, and it was absolutely stunning. So I think whatever happens with this, Auckland, the rest of us are all going to come up, and hopefully those of us who can, and go and participate, whether it's on a screen or we can watch it from the thing, because Auckland is absolutely stunning, and I think we're lucky to have such a beautiful place. So hopefully it works out.
Ruth, you got a comment or a question for Penny?
Well, Penny, I did see a late update today that maybe Team New Zealand has now written to the other challengers saying, OK, well, we're not going to train on B and C, so it's now a fair playing water, whatever you call it.
Yeah.
Is that right? Hopefully we're good.
Yeah, well, I'd say hopefully we're good. They've got to accept that, because Emirates Team New Zealand doesn't sail in the Prada Cup. They sail in the World Series and all that, but not in the Prada Cup. And therefore, while the other guys are working out who's going to be their challenger, Emirates Team New Zealand has to go out and practice and do stuff on a course somewhere. And they were just wanting to go there. And I must say, the last greatest vantage point I've ever seen for an America's Cup was definitely San Francisco.
Oh.
And it was great. A beanbag, a bleacher, a beach, a wall.
It's full of COVID. We're not going there, Penny.
I've got to tell you, North Head's better. You get your cushion and come up here, you'll be fine.
Penny, nice to have you on. Hey, before you go, look, racing begins a week before Christmas when all four teams sail in a build-up regatta in Auckland. You're looking forward to it?
Oh, I'm really looking forward to it. 17th of December, I will have my cushion and I'll be there.
Good on you. Penny Whiting there, sailing commentator, yachtswoman, and got an MBE recipient. Indeed she is, absolutely. Just around the panel before we move on, America's Cup, because some might sort of text in and say, actually, it's quite an elitist thing and it's just for a small minority. But is it something that, well, you first, Sam, is it something that you get behind, or doesn't appeal or apply to you?
Well, I'm not a huge sporty, but I think it is. It's important. And you know what? I hope it just educates people about sailing. It's a great sport and it's actually quite an accessible sport. And the sailing clubs all around the country, and we should learn more about the water. So I hope it goes well.
What about you, Ruth?
Yeah, I do think it's elitist, and I think there are other things that we could be spending our pūtea on. But that said, I was pretty disgraced that we even got to this point where Phil Goff had to have this meeting today, because as a ratepayer and a taxpayer, surely our interests should have been protected well before now.
What else would you like to be had to have your money spent on? If it wasn't...
Housing.
All right.
I don't think they're mutually exclusive. Like, we have to have that. Like, it's just you've got this. You've got the wind and the sea on our doorstep, and let's utilise it. So I think the numbers were done on economic development in Auckland. I take your point, though, Ruth. It is.
Yeah, I don't disagree. There's plenty of economic development opportunity, but I think until you get your some of your housing and basic needs sorted, I think there are other priorities first.
Right. 21 minutes past for the panel. RNZ National with us this afternoon is Ruth Money and Sam Johnston on the program. Now, the three strikes law introduced by the National-led government in 2010 might now be re-looked at now that Labor is back in. The Labor Party tried to repeal it in the last term but was blocked by coalition partner New Zealand First. So, we thought we'd ask, 10 years on, what effect has the three strikes law had? It was based on Californian legislation and was introduced by the National Liberal government in 2010 as part of its agreement with the ACT Party, with then ACT MPs David Garrett spearheading the issue. With us is Warren Brookbanks, who is a Professor of Criminal Law and Justice Studies at AUT. Professor Brookbanks, welcome to the panel.
Thank you, Wallace. Nice to hear you.
So what is the rationale for three strikes? This was based on US legislation?
Yeah, it was largely based on legislation in California. California has probably more strikers in prison than any other state in America, and it was certainly the model, I think, that was followed. But it was very much the baby of particular individuals in New Zealand. I don't think it was a model that was widely enthused about, but nevertheless, it became part of the criminal justice agenda in 1980.
So, 1980?
Sorry, 2010, was it? What am I
talking? Yeah, 2010, yeah. Hey, look, so explain the concept in a nutshell. The third strike, you get the maximum sentence for whatever the case, right?
Well, that's right. It's an aggravated penalty structure. So on the first strike, you just get the sentence imposed by the court. The second strike, the court has to impose, you have to serve the sentence imposed by the court with no parole. And on the third strike, you've got to serve the maximum sentence available at law without parole.
All right. So, and I'll bring in Ruth, who has views on it too, and Sam, of course. But might that lead to perverse outcomes or not? I mean, I said that New Zealand man, the first one, I think, to actually have this case, have the three strikes, Raven Casey Campbell, 25, he got 7 years for grabbing a prison officer on her bum. The judge at the time said, look, it was harsh, but this is the law.
Well, that's always been the concern. I mean, I've been opposed to this legislation from the outset. I was very outspoken when it was first enacted, and the concerns that we've had is particularly the issue of lack of proportionality, and this was very powerfully demonstrated earlier this year in the case of Mr. Fitzgerald, who was convicted on a third strike of kissing a woman in Cuba Street in Wellington, and because it was his third strike for an indecent assault, he was given 7 years jail. And the Court of Appeal said, well, that's the law, and it's a mandatory sentence, and there's nothing we can do about it, so he has to serve 7 years. That's the real problem. It creates distortions within the system of punishment.
All right, well, let's first go to Ruth Money, who is a victims advocate and would know this law. Ruth, what do you think, 10 years on, the three strikes?
Well, 10 years on, we're only just starting to see
the effects.
The effects, because it takes that long. Our justice system is so darn slow, but it also takes that long for people to get their warnings, serve their sentences as it then incrementally increases, given the strike regime. And also, there are judges can, and I have seen them, if the judge says that it is manifestly unjust, then they can opt out of the three strikes regime.
They've got that option.
They have got that option.
Warren?
Can we qualify that? They can opt out of the non-parole.
Non-parole.
Opt out of the three strikes regime itself. That's an important qualification.
Yep. And just like people who oppose three strikes can serve up Fitzgerald as an example, then people who think that the three strikes, in theory, although I agree with people, it isn't working to the intent of Parliament. But, you know, if you look at Wiremu Allen, for example, July 2020, this was his third strike. He broke into a house, he demanded money, punched the victim. The victim was shot in the knee, albeit accidentally, but they were carrying guns. Now, he's got over 60 convictions, including assaulting his partner, threatening to shoot the police, etc., etc. So the intent of three strikes was it recognised that the community expected to be protected from recidivist serious violent offenders. And three strikes are only relevant for the 40 worst offences in New Zealand. You can't get a strike if you kick over a mailbox or if you do a low-level crime, a so-called low-level crime.
OK, Warren, do you want to comment on what Ruth said?
Well, you know, she's quite right. But it should be noted that under the Act, the Sentencing Act, there are 40 offences which are nominated as strike offences. But the way it's worked out, the vast majority of the strike offences are only relate to three particular types of offence, namely sexual assault, robbery, and serious assaults. And so the vast majority of those 40 crimes never eventuate as strike offences. It's a very small cohort of offences.
But what's wrong with sexual assaults being part of three strikes?
Oh, I'm not saying it shouldn't be part of three strikes. Mm. But the fact is that the three strikes law, although it nominates a large number of offences, it's a relatively small number that dominate those statistics.
Well, that and I don't want to get all technical for listeners and get all nerdy on it, but when I sit in court, I can see charges and charge compromises happening to avoid strike offences and to plea out because, and this is why this law doesn't work, judges do not like to be told what to do and it is dysfunctional. So I don't disagree that it needs to be looked at,
okay. But
I do think there are other priorities.
Sam, let's bring you in. Do you have a thought, comment or a question for Professor Bookbank?
No, I just note, I mean, it's not my area, but I just do note that there's a Curia poll that says only 20% of the population disagree or disapprove of the law, which probably is a couple of things. One, not everyone understands it fully or deeply like the others on the panel do. But, I mean, I'd be worried if it was repealed because I'm not sure what the unintended consequences are. And it was interesting reading about the guy who grabbed the woman on the bum to that his second strike was when he got drunk and stabbed someone in the leg. Now, Ruth, you know this intimately more than me, but that would be my concerns, and perhaps, Warren, you could elaborate further on actually where this has worked well and those unintended consequences of undoing it versus the government actually focusing on significant investment in rehab, which is
yes.
where I
Warren?
Think the energy needs to go.
Warren?
Yeah. Well, look, I agree with that. And, I mean, the reality is that at the moment there is really no clear indication of whether the three strikes law is deterring individuals from committing qualifying offences. We just simply don't know because there haven't been enough data crunched.
Isn't that the point? It acts as you go, oh my goodness, I will never commit again because it's the end.
Well, one of the things about the three strikes law was advocated as dealing with the worst of the worst offenders. In reality, it's dealing with the most ordinary of the most ordinary because the vast majority of first strikers are young offenders, Maori or Pacifica. So it tends to be very discriminatory against particular minorities and is dealing with the people who are the people committing most of the serious offences anyhow. So there's no sense in which it's really dealing with the worst of the worst. And certainly if that was meant to be homicide offenders, I think 1.2% of strike offences were for people who committed homicide. So that...
Well, all right, a quick response to that, Ruth Bunny?
Well, with respect, those sentences are longer, right? So if they commit homicide, they'll get their first strike warning. You know, they'll still be in prison because it's only 10 years ago. So let's see if they then get out and do it again. I think the other thing that listeners should be aware of is that when three strikes was introduced in 2010, part of that introduction into the Sentencing Act was life without parole, which if we did not have that awful man that did that horrible Christchurch the 15th mosque attack would not have been able to be sentenced to life without parole. So let's not just chuck the baby out with the bathwater. Let's do some mahi around this and think about there are other priorities, rehab and reintegration. You know, we've only got 108 second strikers. We've got 9 third strikers. So you're talking about 117 people versus 9,400.
Right. So on a final comment from Professor Brookbanks before we go.
Well, I mean, you know, you can argue the three strikes both ways, I guess. My beef is that really I think our criminal law is very, very robust and we frankly didn't need it. And in a real sense, in introducing three strikes, the government was introducing a wheel that was already broken, and certainly experience in America states has shown that three strikes has caused very major distortions within the criminal justice system.
Right.
Increased the rate of imprisonment. Sadly.
We could have a half an hour discussion on this, I'm sure. It's nice to have you on the program, Professor Brookbanks. I do appreciate it. That's Warren Brookbanks there, criminal law and justice professor at AUT. With Ruth Money and Sam Johnson this afternoon, much to discuss, including buyer beware. battery issues with second-hand electric cars. So we return to an old favourite, EVs. Time for headlines.